Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Jack Sage is speaking on prehistory to early explorers in Washington State. So let's listen in on Jack Sage.
It'll be a study of the early Washington past from about 12,000 years ago as revealed in archaeological discoveries. Also a study of later explorations from the 1500s up to the first settlements inside the present boundaries of the state. I have some books. I have a bibliography back here that you can pick up on some of the research I've done. I got loose in this library a while ago, and I found 6 books. Now, five of the six you will be of interest. The sixth one was about one of my ancestors. And believe it or not, this ancestor of mine. I'm going to have to move this up a little closer. They'll pick it up. This title of this book was an old one. It's called Vigilantes, Days and Ways by N.P. Langford, and it was printed in 1912. The original book, the one he copied it from, was about 1864. Anyway, one of my relatives... wasn't a preacher or a teacher, he strayed. And in this book, I looked in the index. That's the first thing you do when you find an old historical book, is look in the index. And I looked in it, and he had his name in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 12 pages about this. And he was a great uncle of mine. It was a favorite brother of my great grandmother, who I knew. They came in the 1843 wagon train. He was just a little lad. My great-grandmother was only 5 years of age. They had the gold rush in Idaho and Montana, 1862 and 1863. The ones that got there in 1862 got all staked all the claims out. So these latecomers, like my great-uncle, they had to find another way of making a living. And so they became road agents. And so who did they work for? But a gentleman by the name of Henry Plummer, the appointed and elected sheriff of Bannon County in Montana. And of course, what he did, he got information every time a miner would bring his poke into town and brag about it, he would inform one of his men. Now, this uncle of mine was what they called a road agent. He was involved in quite a few things, but the very end, I think it's kind of religious. And I thought maybe this might be a good place. It said, this is a winter of 1863 and 64 in Montana and Idaho border. It's up in the mountains just before you get into Idaho. It says, the party that arrested Zachary arrived with him. A letter was written to his mother, not Sarah, that was my great-great-grandmother, warned his brothers and sisters, and one of them was my great-great-grandmother, Catherine, to avoid drinking, card playing, and bad company, which brought him to the gallows. On the scaffold, he prayed that God would forgive the vigilantes for what they were doing, as it was the only way to clear the country of road agents. He died without apparent fear or suffering. You'll find strange things in history if you go through it. I just started a few years ago on genealogy, and only ones I could find anything at first were my bad ones. But the best thing about when you take genealogy, I hope a lot of you eventually will take genealogy and really research your family, because the history in this country, and in fact in Washington, is based a lot on people, not on the leaders. The leaders had very little. If the leaders are by themselves, they wouldn't have done a thing. It was, and that's true, and that's what happened with Henry Plummer's gang. He didn't do a thing, but he had all these. He had about 50 conspirators who did all his work. They killed at least 100 people. Mine, as far as I know, my uncle didn't. I don't think he was that good a shot, for one thing. But history is so important. And your family, you have to relate history to genealogy. And this is what I've done in the Northwest. My family has been out here since 1843. I'm the fifth generation of the family that came in the 1843 wagon train. And my grandkids are the seventh generation, and they are proud of it. Over here, I have a book that I did on this Zachary family when I found out the good things and I found out the bad things, so I only put one paragraph about Bob Zachary. But you must do that while before you get too old, and I'm getting there. I write a journal every night, even when my minister tells me that I should be doing something else. But I do write a journal, 150 words a night, and I've been doing that for just about 10 years. If I don't do at least 150, I do make up for it the next day. I did 300 for one night since I've been here. You have to be careful what you say and do around me because it ends up in a journal. Someday somebody's going to write a history and they're going to come across your name. And this is what history is. And this is one of the important things about the state of Washington. We do not have too many personal histories written about the state of Washington. And I've had to dig and dig. Now, I have over here a book. It's kind of like a textbook they have in high schools and colleges now on Washington history. I've never taken it because they didn't have it in my day. They just invented the printing press, I think, because they didn't have it. But the book here is very good. In fact, I got looking at it, and they must have copied some of my material because it's very similar. Okay, I divide this into three sections. The first session is about the geologic background, and I don't want to give you too much of that because there's a geologist who is teaching. But I will tell you a little bit about it. The second part will be on archaeology, the first inhabitants, and here's a brochure, and I also have a book, which is probably one of the best ones I've ever seen, about the cultures, early cultures, from about 16,000 years ago to up to about 500 years ago. And most of it is on the Native Americans, as we call them, or the Indians, as I used to call them. Okay, the Washington State is part of the Pacific Rim. And we call that the fire and ice time period. And it runs from Northern California through Oregon, Washington, a little bit of the Canadian coast, Alaska, goes up to the area of the 10,000 smokes in Alaska. It goes across the Bering Straits into Siberia, Russia, and down to Japan. That is an area of the Earth that's still in transition. We have volcanoes, we have earthquakes because the plates underneath the Earth are shifting, and it's a very new area. In fact, they say that Washington State is probably one of the youngest. It's only about 20 to 40 million years old, the land area, not anything else. It has been subject to many extreme physical changes. One of the things that we had was the basaltic flows, or the lava. Now, you often think of the lava coming from volcanoes. The lava we have in Washington State and part of eastern Oregon comes from underground. It came through fissures in the ground, and it was up to about 13 million years ago. All of you who have heard about the basaltic layer, it's in some areas it's 2,000 feet thick. Most of central Washington even this area has a basaltic layer in it. It comes from this heated, I'm not sure, the lava that comes from the Earth's core. Columbia Basin, for instance, has the thickest, and it's very rugged. Those of you who have got a chance to go over by Cooley Dam, which has changed a lot of our environment. Right after we had the lava flow coming up, we had an ice age. Now, the world is, I heard one time it was only 4,000 years old, but we think it's a little older. And the ice age lasted until about 2 million years ago. And that time, most of the Earth was covered with a mantle of ice. Why it came back after the lava was there, we don't know. But it did change places like the present state of Washington. We had this ice age last until about 10,000 years ago, and when it receded up to the Canadian border. And that's the last of it. But we had people down here who were right on the edge of it, evidently, because they were here, we figure, up to 16,000 years ago. And these people, I'll get back to where they came from. This intermittent ice flow and the lava flow caused a lot of problems in the area. It's a good thing that we didn't have any people living here. The glaciers were back clear into Montana, and they blocked all the rivers at one time. When this ice dam broke, and this was, over 2,000 years ago, at least. Oh, no, it's more than that. About 2 million years ago. It broke loose, and when it came down, it gouged out what we call coulees, or valleys. It gouged them out from the western Montana all the way to where the present Columbia River is. When it came out, it hit dry falls, and it created dry falls. The Columbia River didn't used to go where it is now. It used to go straight. When it came down to where dry falls out, it gouged out through the rock, through the lava, an area 3 miles wide and 300 to 400 feet high. It was the greatest torrent river in the world at that time, and I don't think it's ever been since. It was so powerful that it gouged out all these coulees. Now, they're very steep. They're like this, where Lake Chelan is, very similar, which is also glaciated. This lava that came up from below covered all but some of the highest buttes. Now, in eastern Washington, we have one that's called Steptoe Butte. And those of you who know a little bit of your Indian history, 1858, a gentleman by the name of Colonel Steptoe decided to go from Fort Walla Walla up to near Spokane and clear the Indians out because they were killing prospectors and making it life rough for a few farmers that we had in 1858. He got up to this high butte, and he was defeated by a group of about 4 or 5 different Indian tribes who drove him back to Walla Walla. This Colonel Steptoe's life was saved by one of our converts our early missionaries, a fellow by the name of Chief Timothy. Chief Timothy showed him a secret way to get out, and nearly all of them, except about a dozen, survived the attack. This is the only time we ever named a monument after a defeated officer. Steptoe Butte is a very high point, and you can see that for 50 miles away. When you're driving on I-90, you get near Ritzville, you can look and you can see it in the distance. This Steptoe Butte, after that, anything that's stuck up high above lava anywhere in the world is called a Steptoe, with a small s. And we can credit a poor defeated colonel for his name perpetuating landmarks. Also, this lava, when it came down, it enclosed a lot of timber and stuff that we hear. One time, the central Washington area was semi-tropical as well as temperate. And some of the vegetation they had in there was, they had ginkgo trees. Now, if you've been to over near Vantage, there's a ginkgo state park. It's a petrified forest park. And this ginkgo tree, the only place you'll find it today is in China. And it had to be in a semi-tropical area. It was encased, when you have a lava come around, it removes all the wood fibers and it replaces it with a rosin and other type of mineral. Beautiful stuff. This petrified wood was so pretty that the state park took it over to keep the ones from digging it. However, I know where another area is because my grandparents homesteaded between Yakima and Ellensburg on what they call Umtanum Creek. They had 1,600 acres, which is now part of a wilderness park, so you can't go in there and dig it. But the hills are just full of them. And when I was younger and more ambitious, I used to go up and I'd load a log into the back of a trunk of a car, and we used to haul back for souvenirs. Thankfully, no longer can they do that. Well, also, when you had this lava, it also preserved a lot of animals who we won't find in this area. And these animals are in semi-tropical and temperate areas. Rhinoceros. These have been found in Washington, state of Washington. Lions, camels, mastodons, mammoths. And they had one they called an oreodon, which is a prehistoric animal related to deer, camels, and hogs. Now, what a relationship those. I couldn't figure that out, but that's what they call them. But then also they have dogs, wildcats, deer, saber-toothed tigers, broad-faced oxen, and mylodon, and early ground sloth. Now these, they found the fossils in this state of Washington. This little folder is free, and I couldn't find any more, but I have a book that this introduced that book, and it's put out by two very well-known archaeologists from our state of Washington. One of them is Ruth Kirk, who does a lot of writing and photography. Another one is Rich Daugherty, who is from my favorite college, Washington State University, and Pullman. They have done a real good job. There's 18 sites listed in the state of Washington. 11 of them are in what we call Western Washington, and the other eight are located in Eastern Washington. I have gone to about half of them in my time. My wife gets upset because I take side trips once in a while to areas of no interest to her, but the fossils are. One of the most interesting, I think, is Marmos Man, and it's over there by Palouse Falls in Eastern Washington. It was found before they put a dam in down below it. When they put that dam in, the water started to fill up. And so they dug as fast as they could, and then they encased the rest of the relics and so forth of the early man. They found the relics of burial sites and everything else, and that was about 10,000 years ago, 10 to 11,000 years ago. They had to cover it with plastic and recover it, and it's underwater now. And they'll be like that until our dams finally are removed. One of the things about our state of Washington is we have such a power potential. We have 27 federal dams on the Columbia River and its tributaries all over the Northwest. We have over 100 additional federal and other dams that are not used for generating power. This has caused us many problems in the Northwest. It causes our salmon. It has kind of slowed the Columbia down. Columbia used to be a mighty thing. Yes, go ahead. We have 27 federal dams, and that includes the Snake, the Clear, the Spokane River. Now, these are federal dams only. We have a lot of state dams that are not in that, that do affect the flow into the Columbia. When they put Cooley Dam in, it backs up the water clear up to Canada. We have another dam also in Western Washington, Ross Dam, which is owned by Seattle Public Power. When they put it in, it backs the water clear up into Canada, and it flooded their land. So whenever we put these dams in, we have to have peace agreements with Canada or other countries, and it's kind of a touchy thing. It does upset them. Now, when they put the Columbia River in, I was up there. I was just pretty young. I was just a kid. You know? They started in 1934. When Franklin Roosevelt came in, one of the things we had was a big depression going on. And we needed employment, and also we needed power. And so he did two things. He started the Works Progress Administration, and then the power. After that, it was the Public Works Administration that changed the name. But they decided to put some dams in. They put in Bonneville Dam first, which is down close to the Dalles in lower Columbia River. That one went in first. Then they put in the Grand Coulee Dam. And that was quite a project. It took years to do it. They started it, and I remember we went down to watch it, and we go down every year, and they go just a little higher, a little higher. They had a conveyor belt that went 20 miles, I think it was, to carry gravel and the aggregate for it. They poured continuously for several years, but they put a lot of people to work. It gave a lot of people an occupation and a vocation that they didn't have before. But it did dam up the water, but it gave us the greatest potential electric power that anywhere in the world at that time. Now it's been challenged. Just recently, not too long ago, they put in the fourth powerhouse, which is across the river, and which generates more power than probably the United States could use, really. It was a good thing we had that, because World War II came along, and we had to needed aluminum for our airplanes. And so the only place you could have it was a state or a location that had a lot of electrical power to melt the bauxite to make your aluminum. And so we had plants all over. We had them in Spokane. We had them in, and they're all on the power grid, Vancouver. We had them in Tacoma. We had them everywhere, those aluminum plants. Also, we needed the power for building ships. Now, Tacoma and Seattle built a lot of, they built aircraft carriers. They put them out very fast. Boeing put out, every few minutes, they put out a B-20, a B-17. And thankfully, a lot of my buddies were with that, because that was a very good plan. But they used that power. I don't know what we would have done. The second thing, and of course we have a lot of criticism on, is the atomic power was developed. They put in the plants, and the nuclear plants, and they've caused us problems. But the only thing good that I know, because I was in the service, is that war was dragging on and on. It was almost 4 years. And finally, President Truman asked the Japanese if they would give up, and they wouldn't. And they had a small raise. And finally, they dropped two atomic bombs, and it killed a lot of people, but it probably prevented a lot of the, not only the Americans, but Japanese from being killed from an invasion, because it was a real tough war. But that power that we had there, and the water from the Columbia River. The water from the Columbia River is used to cool all the year, nuclear rods and so forth in there. And that did cause some of the problems. Okay, I got off of that. Have any questions?
What was that work program called, Roosevelt Prairie?
That was Works Progress Administration. And then later it's called the Power Public Works Administration.
Could women be in it?
Yes. In fact, I want to get you. You women are going to leave us. Women are the most important thing in the war effort in the state of Washington, because we lost all the men, and we had these ships coming in, and these women could do things that a lot of men couldn't do. They cut the plates, steel plates, to build these ships. They built destroyers. Aircraft carriers and everything. They worked. The women did the work. You probably heard of Rosie the Riveter. That was a song we had. Rosie the Riveter. We had lots of Rosies, and they built a. And also, we used them in the planes. Now, when the Boeing built their B-17, near the tail, it was crowded. I remember before they put the turrets in, you could hardly get in. Women had smaller hands, and they could do the wiring better than the men. And we hate to admit it, but they did a better job on it. And they're very precise on. One of the bad things, though, after the war was over, a lot of the women lost their jobs. Now, I was a railroader just briefly before I went to war, and then when I came back, I started in. The men came back, and the women lost their jobs in the railroad. Now, they were all telegraphers and agents and so forth, did a very good job. Also, during the war, they had women who were working on the railroad maintenance sections. They did the maintenance work. We always had these big burly men bragging about spiking and so forth during World War II. And also, we had some of them working during the Vietnam War. We had some of the women on the section crews, and that's tough work. I did that until I decided an education was better to do than to work on the track, because it's tough work. But women were so important to our country, and they still are. As our minister can attest, I think half of them in seminary now are women. That we send a seminary school, United Methodist Church. We men are starting to recognize them. And of course, a lot of it is. I think a lot of it is because I have four granddaughters, two daughters, two daughter-in-laws, and a wife, and the only male in my household usually is my cat. And we're both henpecked. Okay.
I don't believe that.
Can't believe that.
Yeah, you know my wife. You should know better.
We don't
know. Okay, the early... I will just mention briefly some of this. These are our early inhabitants, and like I said, they're from 16,000 to 10,000 years ago. They showed up. We have evidence. Now, the one at the Manus site, which is up at Squim. Now, Squim is spelled, for you Minnesotans, it's S-E-Q. We don't say Sequim, it's Squim. Squim has a fellow was digging a duck pond, and he was digging it to, and he hit a mastodon. First he hit a tusk, and he kept digging, and he found the rest of it. And so now he has no duck pond, because they made a protected site out. But it's interesting. I got up there before they started closing it up.
Is it
Squim? A Squim. As you come into Squim. Now, Squim is up by Port Angeles, across from Vancouver Island. As you go up what we call 101, you go through Squim, and before you go through Port Townsend first, then Squim, you turn left in the middle of Squim, and you go up on the hill, and you'll see it. And it's a private farm, and he took advantage of us. He has a little museum set up, and he has little samples. It's interesting. That was one of the things I mentioned, was mastodons. What was that?
What's the museum called?
Manus, M-A-N-I-S. Manus, mastodon.
If you're coming that, like toward PA, if you're coming that way, mm-hmm. from east to west, it's on the left side?
On the left, on the hillside.
About halfway into the city, after the village.
Yeah, you can, all the roads end up to it, really. You know, Squim's not that big on that side. And it's you'll go up there and you'll see an open, big open field, and you'll see a building out there. It's kind of a fairly new little building.
Probably marked on the highway.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And our senior group in our church. You know, Ken was another one that used to lead us. We go to all these different places, and I don't know if we've made that one. We did go to the game farm. I remember that. But these things are in the state of they're all accessible. It's so interesting. If you ever get a chance to go, do so.
Where did you get that?
Okay. A woman, I listen to women speakers. And this Ruth Kirk, she's one of my favorites. Because she published this book. She's published many books. And she's a good photographer. And she's a good hiker. She's hiked a lot of the trails. And she's done trail books. I asked the Holden Village to recommend this book, but it's they didn't have it up here in the books store. It's called Exploring Washington's Past, A Road Guide to History, and it has a lot of this in it. It's written by this Ruth Kirk, and the bibliography is on there, and you can pick one up when the class is over. And this is a road guide to history, and it has all these things in there. Every little town in the state of Washington is mentioned in here, and it has a paragraph or two on each one of them. It mentions all the houses, the Victorian houses, like you have in Port Townsend, Port Angeles, and Port Gamble, and a few of the other. It's a wonderful book. It cost only $19.95. To me, that's reasonable. It tells you exactly how to get to everywhere. And if you get a chance to pick one up, do so.
The title again?
It's Exploring Washington's Past, and I have a bibliography that has all these on here. In fact, if you want to pass them around, you could do it. I've got some more. I found so many things in the state of Washington. We have press. University of Washington Press does a lot of them. Washington State College, Washington State University Press does a lot of them. I get some from Oklahoma University. Also prints a lot of the things for us up here. I'm not sure who printed this one. I think it was University of Washington Press. I hate to mention it, that's not my favorite school, but they do a lot of good they do a lot of good things. All right, that's all I will do on this. We have some on the way out. Now, if you go through Wenatchee, I don't know if you can get into the orchard, but they found some spear points. A man was working in his orchard, and he found the spear points, and he was going to keep them for himself. And we made arrangements to preserve these spear points. Now, they're longer. They're not like arrowheads, a little bit longer. And they date at least 11,000 years ago. And by luck, that's been preserved. One of the trips, you younger ones who like to hike, is out at Ozette. Now, if you go up to Nia Bay, and I'll mention Nia Bay again, another area. Reason They have one of the best Indian museums I've ever seen, and it's artifacts from the Ozette Dig. Now, Ozette had an Indian village next to the bluffs. They had a mudslide about 500 years ago. It came down and then covered everything up. Now, usually when you have the baskets and so forth, they are destroyed, and everything made of wood or cloth was preserved. And so they've been able to know what the culture was like over 500 years ago, and probably much longer than that, probably up to 2,000 years ago. It was on the coast of a room about this big with a diorama all the way around, with the sea in the background, and then they have the exhibits in the front. And it's so realistic, it looks like you're looking out in the ocean. That's at Nia Bay, and as you come up one up the highway, I'm not sure what the number is now, they keep changing the state highway. Nia Bay is a, yeah, it's as far as you get. Cape Flattery is a northern and the westernmost point in the contiguous 48. Macaw, M-A-K-A-H. Uh-huh. And they're good. They're basket weavers, they're carvers, and everything else. And so that the one thing about it, we're starting to recognize our Indian tribes as being a essential part of our culture, and we're starting to meet with them. And you know, I'm so glad, because all my ancestors came to Washington. We had to they had to live with the Indians and with them. My grandfather worked in a cattle ranch in the 1880s, and half the employees were Indians, and about a third of them were blacks, and they were very good with cattle. This ranch was so huge, they used the Columbia River and the Yakima River and the Horsehaven Hills as fences. They were too big for the cattle herds. And right now that's a Yakima Indian reservation now. Okay, now, early explorers. Now, you want to take a rest here a bit? Okay. The early explorers. No, I do talk occasionally. As my housemates can testify, I'm kind of a radical in a way, in all the churches. When I went to get off the subject, I joined the Methodist Church about 41 years ago. And when I came to town, my party is very scarce in Eastern Washington. I lean a little to the left. And when I got in to vote, they had voting machines with levers. He had to roll levers for Democrats, one for Republicans. I got in there, and they could hear me struggling, and I'd click, 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 and it says, well, there's a straight Democratic vote. You know, that machine had never been used. That levers had never been used. The minister used to introduce me as the most radical man in town. I was a Democrat and a labor man, and everybody else was wheat farmers and everything else. They let me serve on the school board there for about 2 years until they saw my leanings, and then I finally transferred. Okay, our early explorers, it's very interesting. We had Columbus came over, and he didn't fall off the end of the world in 1492. And so when he came back, well, then the Spanish, the Portuguese, and English, and French decided, well, gee, it's safe to go. And so they were looking for the passage to India, which they never did find. But they came out here as early as the Spain came out here about 1542, up and down the coast. And they, of course, you know, went into Mexico and in the 1500s in California. But they got up here as far as 1542. The first, they came to from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And then later on, they found out that the world was round, and so they came from the Pacific area to the Atlantic. So they made the route. Bering Strait was discovered by a fellow by the name of Vitus Bering. He was a Russian ship, but he was Danish. And I've got to tell that Danish gal about that. He was the one that discovered the Bering Passage. At one time, Asia and North America were joined, and they were what we called a land passage. And we believe that's where these people came up to 16,000 years ago. They didn't come through the ice, so evidently it was warm enough that they could come down, and they kept going south, and eventually they went into the rest of North America. That we believe that's what happened. We also believe a lot of them came from the Orient, from Asia, because although we have no evidence of them being here, but anything fishing nets or anything else that get loose from Japan or a part of China end up on our shores. We have glass balls and stuff. Well, those Washingtonians probably have gone to get them. But when you have a storm in the wintertime, they all come floating in. So we kind of think that they came out. I was looking at an old sailing boat, and they found a vessel that just had a new engine put in China. And they got out of port just a short distance, and the engine died. And we have the Japanese current, which is a big current, and it goes along the rim, the Pacific Rim, the Rim of Fire. It brings anything around it, and it ends up down on our coast and down into Oregon and California. They found this thing adrift. They'd run out of food after 1 month, and it was 3 or 4 months, and so they were all dead. But they'd written messages that they were going to dive and where they were from. So they were able to identify. It looked like a Chinese junk that they were on. But the current, they had no sails, no way to sail back. Okay, after that, Bering Strait, then the Columbia River. In 1790s, we started getting our English and Americans started exploring the coast. Now, for years, the Spanish went by the Columbia River, and they missed it, and the rest of them missed it. And how they could miss that, those of us who have been down there, now, Astoria Column, which is above it, you can look out, you can see the topsoil that goes out for miles and miles. You would recognize that as being from a river, a delta of a river. They passed by it. The first one to get in there was Captain Gray, an English captain, or American captain, rather, who sailed into it, and he had a lot of nerve, because I would never want to go in there but anything smaller than a battleship. That is so rough in there. It's called the graveyard of the ships. There's over 500 ships that are wrecked off of that mouth of that river up and down. Uh-huh. There's another nice place to go. It's Astoria because it's historic. John Jacob Astor had a fur trading post there. Lewis and Clark came there first. 1804, we had the Louisiana Purchase, and they decided, well, we want to see what's there. All they knew, that the new water was on one side of it and Rocky Mountains on the other. So they sent Lewis and Clark out, and he started out with boats, and then he ended up with horses and so forth, and it took him almost 2 years to cover it. He spent the winter, first winter, near Astoria, seaside, and actually it's a little fort that he built. And they stayed in it, and it said it rained continuously. Well, you know, you newcomers don't realize it, that we don't notice it. You know, it's just a mist. But they, it was the first exploration we had of the land. And they went back all the way. They explored into Montana, and also they did set up a route for our later wagon trains to come. They only lost one person out of it. I saw a movie the other day that was a terrible one. There was 4 and 5 and 6 of them dying at a time, and which wasn't true. Sacagawea led it, and they didn't even have her husband with her on the movie. But she came along with a baby, and she led him. She was a Shoshone, and she was very educated, really. She knew various tongues and languages. When you got down to the mouth of the Columbia, they have another one we call the Chinook jargon. Now, the Chinook Indians were great traders. And so anybody that came in there, they'd trade salmon and so forth for goods. They developed a language called a Chinook jargon. And I'll talk a little more about when we get into the Indian history on Wednesday. This Chinook jargon was developed originally from the Indian tongue. And then they worked in English and French, and even a little bit of Scotch. And this is what my grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents used when they didn't want we kids to know what they were talking about. And they were very tricky. Also, there was one other language which, now, see, they talk about English being the first language. It wasn't. It was a second and third. Another language that we had in the western part of the Rocky Mountains was Chinese. They were trying to build the railroads, and they could not get enough whites to come this side of the mountains. The whites did work. They had a lot of Scandinavians and Irish working. That they built a railroad from Minneapolis, St. Paul. They built it to near the Rocky Mountains. But the Chinese came in, and they had 4,000 of them registered at Wasco County, which is at the Dalles, Oregon, because I was looking up records for my grandfather. 4,000 of them registered in one little county, and they used them to build these railroads all by hand. They built the railroad where I was raised in Eastern Washington by hand, and some of them died of disease, and so they wouldn't handle them. They just threw them in a ditch and buried them. And a Chinese, when he dies, he wants his remains to be shipped to China, and they didn't do that because they were scared of these. Cholera was the main thing. Okay, now, the Russians came down. They did a lot of exploring down here about 1728, 1741, and 1790. They established posts all up and down in Canada. But the Spanish established the first one in what we call the state of Washington. And they established one in 1790 or 1791. It was up at Nea Bay, which you mentioned before. It had 10 little houses. And they stayed there, about 1 year. And then they decided to leave. And then the Russians established posts as far down as California. In fact, you'll run into a few of them down there. Sir Francis Drake had a place down there in California. So Captain Cook was up in this area. And he was up here. Well, about 1776, he came north to Cape Flattery, where Nea Bay is, or just around the bend from Nea Bay. He came up that far. Francis Drake came up with his Golden Hind about 1577. Now, I'll get up
to... How far
did
Drake get?
Maybe the coast?
Yeah, they're not sure.
Oh, really?
See, we have a lot of fog on our coast when the... And, they didn't dare get too close. You could hear the breakers. You could hear, because we have a real rocky coast. And so they didn't dare get too close. And so their navigation instruments weren't too accurate. You have to use the sun most of the time, or the moon and the stars. And they didn't have too much close to the coast. So we figure they got it into at least Oregon.
There's a marvelous entry that Drake's journal about how far north he got. Encountered the most vile and stinking fog.
Gee whiz, we didn't have our sewer outflows there either, no. One of the interesting things about the Spanish, they came in and they came down the coast, and near Point Grenville, there's some creeks coming down. And so they decided to send some water parties home, water parties ashore to get fresh water. So they didn't see anybody around, so they sent one party in, and just as soon as they got out of the boats, the Indians came out and killed them. And they sent another one, and the same thing happened. So they have a memorial on the beach. You have to hike to it, to this party. Hacacita, I think is his name, was the one that sailed there. So finally, I suppose they went to a river and got their water eventually. That was one of the hazards of being exploring on the coast, and the other one, of course, was the shipwrecks. Captain Cook discovered and named this Cape Flattery, and I always wondered how it was. It really isn't much of a cape, so it is flattery to call it a cape, I guess. He failed to recognize the Straits of Juan de Fuca, which is a huge thing. Yeah, he didn't recognize that at all. Yeah, the first one to recognize it and really and explore it was Captain Vancouver, who was a British captain. Came in. He could see the Mount Rainier. It was called Mount Tacoma when I went to school because I was in Tacoma. But they called it Mount Tacoma then. But he called it after an admiral who was a friend of his who had never been to America, at this part of America, but he had been in the Revolutionary War and fought against our troops during the Revolutionary War. But he named that after it. And we Tacomans have been trying to change that name ever since. But he came down as... No, he came down into the straits near Seattle, and he anchored. And his ship was called the Admiralty, and it was a big one. He wanted to come down the inside passage, and so he decided to leave the big one there. And so he sent Lieutenant Peter Puget. Now, Lieutenant Peter Puget had a gig and a few other ones. They had a little mast on it and sails. And so they sailed down, and they covered. They went by where Ken lives, Gig Harbor. And one of the first nights, they stayed not too far from where you live, Ken. And they, you know where Raft Island is. They pulled up the beach, and they saw these nice, beautiful blackbirds. And so they, for breakfast, they had crow. And so they named the island Crow Island, but it didn't stay. It's a Raft Island now. Then they sailed up to the inlet by close to Menard Creek, and then they went around. This is an inlet. This inlet is so deep that our nuclear subs use it for sonar testing. They come up from Bremerton, and they go into through the Narrows, and then they go into this inlet that's very deep, and they can do the sonar testing, and fishing boats and stuff do not interfere with the sounds that they get. Then they sailed around to, we have some islands, Anderson Island and so forth. He got close to Steilacoom. They got into a rainstorm, and so they sailed immediately to Anderson Island, which is a small island, and got into a cove. And then they got very close to Olympia. Then they came back. It took them over a week. Well, Captain Vancouver got a little worried about it, and so he took another vessel, and he sailed in. He went to Commencement Bay, where Tacoma is, and he came down as far as Steilacoom, where I live, and turned around and went back. He was out about 3 days, and the others were out a little over a week. They named every spot on there after their friends and their crewmen. And if it was a rainy, they named it Rain Island or something. Anyway, that was the first exploration of what we call the Puget Sound. Now, that is probably the most beautiful inland waters in the world to me. It's beautiful. It was carved by glaciers. It originally, the Olympic Peninsula, to one side, the state of Washington at one time was islands. And the one island way out drifted in, the plates drifted in, just like it was really floating, drifted in until it became a peninsula. It did not quite connect. And that was during the geological period. And then upheavals raise mountains up. You have a Cascade Range in the east, and then you have a coastal range which catches all the rainfall. Now, that's where all our rainforests are. When the winds bring in the clouds, the rain will hits these and raises up, and it drops the rain. We get 200 to 400 inches of rain a year in the rainforest, the heaviest rainfall in the world. We have three major rainforests. If you ever get a chance to go to them, they're on 101 on the other side. The upper one is called the Whole River, and they're all beautiful. Then you have the Queets and you have the Quinault. They're beautiful. And if you ever get a chance, take a vacation and backpack in there. I've gone in the Queets quite often. If you can be in the pouring rain and never get wet, because the moss and everything is growing over. It's a beautiful place. Everything is green and warm. Okay. After that, we had. Is it time? Well,
no.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe you're getting to it, but you haven't mentioned Captain Gray.
Captain Gray discovered the Columbia River.
I know. Mm-hmm. That's not part of Washington, is that?
Sure, it is.
Sure.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was his exploration that saved this part of the state for.
Well, that my next one I'll tell you about what saved the state. Yeah, what he did is.
My problem is I taught Washington history first grade.
Yeah, but see, the British got their foothold in at Fort Vancouver.
What?
See, they got in there about 1810, Fort Vancouver. And so they says all the land north of the river is British Empire, and so. But we were tricky. The 1843 wagon train changed the percentage. Not only that, that's when we brought women. You see, they brought families. Before that, all the trappers and so forth, most of them married Indian wives. They did not bring their wives with them. And so you can see it was a wild area. It was really wild. When they brought the women, the first thing the women do is you get a church. Then they get a school. And then they get rid of the saloons. And you know, they just don't understand entertainment. But that's what they did. And this is a... The 1843 wagon train that came, I'm going to just jump ahead on it. 1843 wagon train had 1,000 people in it. When they came here, they outnumbered the British almost 2-1. And so at that time, there was no government up here. The only government they had was these trading posts. The Hudson Bay trading posts had their own little government. They had their own laws. Well, one of the fellows by the name of Ewing died. He didn't have a will. And this was in 1843. He died, and they had to have a law set up. So then they set up an American government in Oregon. And then this fellow we had by the name of Jason Lee, it was the first missionary into Oregon. He came in 1834. He decided, well, we're going to go up and beat the British we're going to have a mission. So they started a mission right close to where I live in Silicon at Fort Nisqually. And it was only there about 3 or 4 years, but that was the first American child born above the Columbia River, and the first marriage above there, and also later on, it was the first 4th of July celebration, and we let a preacher preach the 4th of July celebration. It was remarkable, and that was kind of tough. Methodists, you know, really got around in those days, Bill. Anyway, that really changed the Northwest. The trappers finally were discouraged. They had left, so then all the Hudson Bay Post changed from trapping to agriculture development. They raised sheep up where we have in the Fort Lewis area and close to where I live in Silicon. They raised vegetables and so forth and made an agricultural development out of it. Where the Fort Silicon is now used to be a Hudson Bay Post. And a fellow by the name of Jacob Heath, or John Heath, he bought the land from the Hudson Bay Company. And he only farmed it about 4 years and he died. And then the U.S. Army came in 1849 because the Indians were shooting settlers and things like that. And so they brought the Army in and they established our Fort Silicon there. And that's where our mental hospital is today. It was as a mental hospital in the 1870s. But that's the early one. 1841. Quick, like, I'll get that one. The United States decided to send a navy around the world. And so they sent Lieutenant Wilkes with a force of explorers, scientists. They mapped... all of the world, all the flora and the fauna in the world. In 1841, they came up Puget Sound. They went to Fort Nisqually, which was built in 1833, and the second one was 1843. But he came with the first one, and that was his headquarters. And they picked up specimens from all over the world. And Smithsonian got a lot of those. And we had the Wilkes celebration. I think that was the 150th celebration not too long ago, 91. We had a special thing. Okay, after that, 1824. When we were starting to push these English out of Oregon, they decided to explore the Puget Sound. They heard it was rich for a trading post. And so it was wintertime in December, and they had 36 people, about 3 boats. Instead of going out in the sea and going around in the straits, they did it the hard way. They went up below Cape Disappointment. They dragged those boats across the land up to Willapa Bay, rowed up to Willapa Bay, and dragged it across the land to Grays Harbor. And then they dragged it up and got on the Chehalis River and went up as far as Olympia. About Christmas time, they arrived just off where I live in Silicon. They picked up some Indians for translators and they went all the way up to the Fraser River in British Columbia. They found locations for two trading posts. One of them was at Fort Nisqually, and the other one was in the Fraser River. And so then they started the operations 5 years later, 1833. They started the Fort Nisqually trading post. And then they also started one up in the Fraser River. I'm not sure of the date, because that's Canadian, and I'm not sure when that was started. That brings us up to the present, and this is where I'm going to end on that part of the explorers, because after that, we'll be doing the pioneers and the settlers. We had the wagon trains come out. We had the railroads come out. And before that, sailing vessels came. The only way you could get here for years was by sailing vessels. And everybody that came out here, the missionaries' wives, all suffered a seasickness. And that was their biggest complaint. And they did not treat the missionary families very well. They didn't pay as much as the trappers and the hunters and the gold miners and so forth. A lot of our early missionaries, Blaine that came to Seattle, came up. We had a fellow, the Mercer, who was in Seattle, and he was worried because there was a lot of bachelors running around carousing on the skid road instead of spending money as merchants. So he put an order into back east for women to come out to marry these single bachelors. And so he was going to get 100, but he didn't get that many by far. And some of them came out, and they did marry these guys. I don't know why they'd marry these guys, but they cleaned them up a little before they got married. But you can see that women had a very important part in our early history. And the one brief thing I will say about the early history, 1883. Now, the state of Washington allowed the women to vote immediately after they came here on school things. But in 1883, they gave them the right, the territorial legislature gave them the right to vote for any election. Well, then it got timed about 1888, and they began to worry because we were going to become a state in 1889, and they were afraid that the women would have enough power to put into the Constitution that they would have prohibition of liquor. And so they talked the courts into annulling it, and so until 1910, women in the state of Washington did not have a right to vote. They were 10 years ahead of the women in the United States. They didn't get the right to vote until 1920, but we were 10 years ahead. We had an aggressive bunch of women suffragettes, and that will be my last session on Friday about the women who were so important in our history. Yes?
How did the state choose the name of Washington? And is it after George Washington?
It's after George.
Mm-hmm. Was that a state vote?
Not really. A lot of these things, now like our state here, now they didn't say how most of our counties are named after presidents and things like that. They were really patriotic out here.
Isn't this the only state with women named after a president?
It's the only one named after a president.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know all the details, but part of it was that Congress decided that something should be named for Washington. A lot of the people who lived here wanted to really call it Columbia,
yeah.
But had to make some compromises to achieve statehood.
Now they did. They named it. One that named it Columbia because Gray's ship was the name of it was the Columbia, and that's why they.
And that was the one that Gray was on.
Uh huh.
He was British though.
Yes. No. He's English. No. Now he was our American. Yeah, he was our first American to discover the Columbia River.
Oh.
And he's the first one to do the exploration, American.
But his ship is called the Columbia?
Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Have you read Dick Noakes' book on the Gray?
Yeah, there's in fact, I've got some books that, if you get a chance, quick-like.
I was in school and I was with Dick Noakes.
Oh, is that right? We have so many good writers up in the Northwest. Anyway, if you go into the library, which is straight through, and on the right, there's some books that you may be interested in. One is about, it's autobiography essays by Native American writers. It says, I'll Tell You Now, and it's on the bookshelf. One's on Russian America, The Great Alaskan Adventure from 1741 to 1867. That's also on the rack. Timothy, a Nez Perce chief. There's a book about by Roberta Rowena Alcorn, 1985. Nez Perce Indian Portraits is in there. And then Four Wagons West, The Story of Seattle, which is a good one. And then if you want to read my family's bad one, Vigilante Days and Ways is also on there. Okay, thank you for being here.